This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we start today in Braintree, where on the night of February 16th, Braintree Town Councilor Elizabeth Maglio got a call. On the line was the mayor of her town with some news. There was a two-alarm fire at the nearby Clean Harbors, the largest hazardous waste facility in New England.
I did exactly what you're not supposed to do, which was run out the front door because behind the house across the street, I could see the fire and the smoke.
Once outside, Maglio saw a plume of smoke and heard explosions from the fire.
I heard a pop, and then I heard another pop.
No one was injured in the blaze, but several trailers were destroyed. And still, for many in Braintree and the surrounding area, the fire laid bare what's missing in local and regional responses to emergencies. Coordination. Here to talk more about this and more from the newsroom, Miriam Wasser. She's a senior reporter with WBUR's climate and environment team. Always great to have you, Miriam. Welcome back.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Okay, we're going to start with the fire. It exposed a lot of flaws on a lot of fronts, regional and local responses, also physical flaws that made it more difficult to fight. I want to dig deeper on all of those, but let's just go back to the night first and talk about what happened at Clean Harbors.
Sure. So at about 10 p.m., something in this trailer spontaneously combusted.
That can happen.
Yep. Well, the company says that the contents of the trailer had been, of the particular barrel, had been misrepresented by the supplier. So it either shouldn't have been stored this way or wasn't something that was suitable for this facility. So at Clean Harbors, there's, you know, this loading dock, and there are 8 tractor trailers that temporarily store waste coming in and out. One of them spontaneously combusted. The fire spread. The fire department showed up pretty quickly, but immediately they ran into problems. The first hydrant they tried to plug into didn't have sufficient water pressure, and the fire chief later said that delayed them by 4 or 5 minutes and allowed the fire to spread to 2 more trailers. Later on, they encountered another hydrant that didn't work, and then quickly they ran into another problem, which is that trailers that house hazardous materials like this have a list on the outside, a placard saying what's in it for exactly this situation, but because of the fire, they had melted off. So they were...
I'm sorry, that's not funny, but holy cow.
I know. No, luckily, people from Clean Harbors were able to get to the site pretty quickly, and they were able to say, they didn't have, like, an exact list, I think, of what was in there, but they were able to say, for instance, keep your water on this particular trailer over here because there's tens of thousands of flammable, or gallons of flammable material in here. So
we don't want this one to catch on fire.
Yeah.
But some of the other trailers or containers did. That's what you mean by the fire spread.
Yep. In all, 3 trailers were completely burned.
Okay. So what did residents have to say after this happened?
I mean, people were totally freaked out, right? Like, at about 11 o'clock that night, the mayor of Braintree put a note on Facebook saying that there's this fire happening. We don't know exactly what's going on, but out of an abundance of caution, close your windows, stay inside. As you can imagine, a lot of people didn't get that message in Braintree, let alone nearby Quincy and Weymouth. So they wake up in the morning, they see this on the news, they're freaked out.
Yeah.
And this all came out at a town council meeting a few weeks later. I think we have some tape from that.
You could have called and said, we're erring on the side of caution. Please keep your windows closed.
I didn't know what was happening until the next morning. I panicked.
We walked to school the next morning and stood outside at lineup for 15 minutes. Were the kids in danger?
That was Lorraine Liston, Leland Dingy, and Megan Feldposh.
So were the kids in danger?
Okay, that's the, like, bajillion-dollar question here. Some people reported feeling some sort of, like, burning sensation in their throats the night of the fire. Others said the air smelled like melting plastic. I talked with one young girl whose younger sister slept with her window open that night, and when she woke up, her eyes were all red and puffy. At least initially, Clean Harbors wasn't exactly saying what was in the trailers, which I think added to the feeling that a lot of residents had that, like, something really bad had happened and was being covered up. And as you mentioned in the opening, this was 2 weeks after the train derailment in East Palestine, Ohio. So that's, like, playing in the background.
Yeah, people are sort of heightened in their worries.
Absolutely. A little while later, Clean Harbors did say, you know, the trailers that burned contained things like paints, epoxies, oil filters, various other solvents. So things that we know if they burned and got into the air and people inhaled them, it would be bad for them. But we can't exactly say that happened, right? The wind was moving all over the place that night. You would need a deeper study to know exactly what happened.
But you talked to an expert who didn't necessarily find that credible, right?
Right. So Clean Harbors and the state have said, we do not think this fire posed a risk to people. One person I talked to was Philip Landrigan, who, like, this is his expertise. He's at Boston University. And he said, you know, I take issue with that. And here's a little bit of what he said.
There's no way I can believe that there was no air pollution generated in that fire. The facts speak for themselves that very, very high levels of particulates were recorded at several different air monitors in the neighborhood surrounding the site.
So, okay, so what he's saying is that in nearby Weymouth and in areas around there, there are a lot of air monitors. There's one that's owned by the state, and then there are several that are through this company called Purple Air. You can have like a little personalized air monitor in your backyard if you want. And all of them registered really high spikes for a couple hours during the fire. And that is what you would expect to see during a fire. And we know that even short-term exposure to particulate matter like that can exacerbate health or can be a big health risk for people with existing health problems. But it also, he said, can be an indication that there are other things in the air too, that the same place you would register high particulate matter, you might have high levels of toxins in the same plume. Should add that the state is saying still to this day that doesn't seem to be the case. But people are concerned and people are skeptical.
All right. So you've already touched on some of the flaws of that night, right? The melting placards, the fire hydrants not working correctly. But the other thing that really came out of this were the flaws in regional communication. I mean, the air doesn't stay to town borders, right? And the communication didn't get to people even in the town of Braintree. So in our limited time, talk a little bit about that.
Sure. So in the state of Massachusetts, every town or city is required to have some sort of emergency response plan. But what is not necessarily required is a regional response plan. And what people in this area have been clamoring for years is a regional response plan for Quincy, Braintree, and Weymouth. This area right by Clean Harbors has a lot of industrial facilities, and a lot of those facilities work with potentially hazardous materials. You know, you have Clean Harbors, for instance, you have the Weymouth Natural Gas Compressor Station, there are two power plants, a chemical manufacturing facility, two fuel tank farms, and there's one other that I'm blanking on at the moment, but there's a lot. There's a lot there. And, you know, had this fire at Clean Harbors not gotten completely under control, it could have spread to the fuel tank farms. And what would happen if that caught fire? And, you know, people have just been saying for years, we really want a plan. Like, how are we going to let people know if something is wrong? How are we going to evacuate the area? And I think that this fire in some ways might be a turning point in that you had a lot of local officials saying, yeah, maybe we do need something more.
So, Miriam, we have about 30 seconds left. And one of the things that I've come to rely on with you and your reporting is you really have a catbird seat and are starting to see patterns now, right? And people are talking to you and they're relying on you. As you look forward, what are you watching next in this story and regionally now as you gather all this information?
Sure. In the specific context of this story, I'll be looking for future studies that are going to come out that might tell us a little bit more about where the plume of smoke went and what the impacts could be. But I think if we sort of zoom out and think about the bigger picture, this is a story about what happens when you site a lot of industrial infrastructure in one area that's surrounded by people and how you keep everyone safe.
WBUR's Miriam Wasser, senior reporter on climate and the environment, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. And as of today, you have 15 days to file your taxes. If you have not done so yet, don't worry. We've got you. And if you have, we're still here to give you some information that you might not know. It is our latest Budget Boston. And here to help us, Ansel Tejada, He is the Program Manager of Financial Empowerment at the Massachusetts Association for Community Action, or MASCAP. And Evan George, host of Bostopia News, a weekly news podcast covering all things Boston. Evan, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And Ansel, welcome back to you.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you back. Ansel, I'm going to start with you. You've boiled down doing taxes into five basic steps. Let's hit them bam, bam, bam. What are they?
Get prepared. Know your stuff, know where your money came in, know where your money went out. Don't worry so much about the names of all your documents, and go get some help if you really need it.
And there's a lot of help out there, isn't
there? Absolutely. There's a lot of help, and especially free help for a lot of my clients.
Okay, so Evan, quick lightning round for you. I'm going to give you three true or false questions.
Ooh,
you ready?
All right, let's do it.
All right, true or false, tax returns will likely be lower this year.
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. The new child tax credit only benefits families with children under 13.
So that is not as... That's half correct.
Half correct.
Part of Mauro Healey's new policy that they are trying to pass through is that they are combining the childhood and the family tax credit, and that this new proposal will allow, if you are taking care of a dependent over the age of 65, that will also qualify.
But that hasn't passed yet.
Correct.
Okay. And the April 18th deadline is unusual.
That is also correct. I think everyone has it in their heads. April 15th, we have a few days extra.
Okay, so that is so here's my next question to you. When was the last time that we actually had a deadline of April 15th?
That's a great question, because I know it's something that they decided to start extending even, I think, before the COVID era, as just a way of addressing some gaps in the system, allowing people to know it's April 15th, ooh, actually, you have now a couple more days, because it's really hard for people to meet that deadline. Let's extend things, especially with the SPS system running as slow as it has been over the past decade.
Plus, this year, April 15th is on a weekend, and then I think the 17th is like Emancipation Day in D.C., right?
Correct.
Okay, so Ansel, this is important. If you can't get your taxes filed by April 18th. Is there anything you can do about that?
Well, there's two options. You could always ask for an extension. Make sure that you file that extension before the April 18th deadline. But at the same time, if you are receiving a return, there's also possibilities that you could go ahead and file a little bit afterwards and receive that same return. You just have to kind of make sure that you don't owe any money behind there. And there's a couple of ways that you could do that.
And if you need an extension, but you think you're going to owe money, mm-hmm. do you have to pay some amount of money when you ask for your
extension?
Yeah,
absolutely. Through the state and also through the IRS. And you could both do those through the when you go to a free filing site, such as the Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program.
And Evan, how far out is that extension usually?
That's a great question. I might have to phone a friend to ask Ansel for that.
But all right, Ansel, you are the friend Evan is phoning, so...
It's all the way usually until October 18th, somewhere around there.
So you get a decent amount of
time.
You
got a decent amount.
Okay, so Evan, and we're speaking with Evan George of Bostopia News and Ansel Tejada here of MASCAP as we look at 15 days from now, tick-tock, until taxes are due unless you get an extension until sometime in October.
Yep.
Okay, so Evan, I'm going to turn to you because I know that based on something you said earlier, we've got a set of listeners who haven't been able to listen to anything else because they're like, wait, the tax stuff that Mauro Healey wants to do hasn't passed yet. So quickly take us through this. What are the family and senior items that Governor Healey has proposed quickly? And how will we know if and when those have passed?
Okay, great question. And there's a large series of different tax cuts that Mauro Healey has proposed. This one in particular is probably one of the strongest ones. So what it does is combines two existing tax credits, one that we have for children, one that we have for seniors, and just really simplifies the system and gives some more money. So if this were to pass, and we'll get to when we'll find out about that later, you will receive an extra $600 per year per dependent, and that dependent is going to be 13 years or under, so any child that age, and also 65 years or older. So, for example, if you're caring for an aged parent, $600 per dependent. And now when we will hear about this, as people who follow the Massachusetts State House knows, it is a very slow and grueling process. If I had to place my money on it, though DraftKings doesn't allow sports betting on politics just yet, it would be sometime around June, just as they pass everything else.
And that would then mean that it goes into effect for your 2023 taxes, which you would file next year.
Correct.
Okay, so Ansel, I'm going to go back now because you've made a couple of references to free support for taxes. And I'm going to give an example here. Here's an ad for ABCD in Alston, Brighton, their neighborhood opportunity center.
Free tax prep at ABCD.
I came here to have my taxes done because I've had them done for the last 3 or 4 years here. I keep coming back here because they do a good job. That means a lot because I don't have...
No strings attached. There really are organizations out there that will help people do their taxes for free.
Yeah, absolutely. In the state of Massachusetts, there's over 70 sites in the whole entire state of volunteer income tax assistance sites that will help you free file your taxes when you walk in. ABC is one of the ones that works with Boston Tax Help Coalition, but they also work with MassCap as well, and they help with free filing.
How does one find out who might be able to help them file their taxes for free?
Two ways. You could definitely go to the IRS website. They have a listing on there of all the and go through the VITA site and search for VITA. Or you could go to masscap.org and free tax filing or free tax help. And we have a listing of all of our sites as well.
All right. So what do you bring? Okay. So now I am getting ready to go to a free tax prep site. I can imagine standing in a long line. I get to the desk and they tell me, you don't have everything you need, right? I mean, we've all lived this. So I've got a backpack or a bag. What do I need to have in it to be sure that I've got the materials I need to get help?
So three things. Income. Where do you get your income from? Don't worry about the names of the forms themselves because it could be a W-2 or 1099 or anything. But where did you get money coming in from? Make sure that you have all that information put together of where you got money coming in. Where did you spend that money? If you spent that money, how did it get spent? Where did it get spent and things like that? And also your health insurance information in the state of Massachusetts is required. So make sure that you have that on hand.
How would I have that? Like, did it come in the mail?
Yeah, absolutely. Whether it's MassHealth that will send it out or your job will send it out for you. So their forms is called a 1099-HC in the state of Massachusetts, and you should have that come in the mail and it should be ready for you.
Okay. Now, Evan, I'll turn to you. One of the things that we'll hear program preparers, that's not an easy word to say, like an H&R Block or a TurboTax, sometimes we'll see commercials where they say, hey, if you're due for a return, we'll give you some of that money now, right? It's a prepaid tax return. Mm-hmm. And I'm already seeing Ansel just kind of shake his head over there. So I think I know what the answer to this is, but is that a good deal?
No, it's not. And one of the reasons that our tax system is so complex, no other really comparable nation does it this way, is because of the lobbying efforts done by some of the large tax prepared companies like H&R Block, like Tax Turbo. And while there are so many Americans who qualify to get their taxes done for free, as Ansel was just explaining, organizations like that cannot compete with the advertising budget of H&R Block, Tax Turbo, and so many people right now are desperate for some finances. It seems like a good deal getting that quick buck up front while you are actually going to be losing money in the long run when you go through those services.
Why will you be losing money in the long run? Do you have to pay interest on that money?
Simply because they are going to take a cut from what some of your returns would have been when other nonprofit agencies that don't exist for their own profit but to actually meet the needs of people will not be doing that. So they bribe you with a little bit of cash up front, but you actually would have gotten more in the long run.
You can go to a TurboTax or an H&R Block, though, Ansel, and also get good paid support if you're somebody who doesn't qualify for free tax support, but you're afraid to do it on your own.
Yeah, absolutely. You could definitely go. Just make sure you go to a reputable one. And those upfront loans, I call them a loan because that's what essentially it is. Those upfront payments are definitely not a good idea. They could take up to 10% of your return on there. But also, if you go to the IRS website, IRS Free File, they do have help on there associated. For example, one of them is a Free Tax USA that is absolutely free, and it is sponsored by the IRS themselves. And you could go ahead and file your taxes on your own.
Okay, so Ansel, for those who have already filed this year but are a little anxious if they did it right, what's your number one piece of... Because a year from now, we're going to have to do it again, right? Death and taxes are two of the most consistent things. What's your number one piece of advice for a behavior change people could do in 2023 to be more effective in filing their taxes next year?
Gather your documents as soon as possible. Gather your document as soon as they come in. Remember, if you're a worker, your W-2 should be in the mail way before January 31st. Your health insurance information should be in your mailbox way before January 31st. If you see those things and it's getting to that January 31st and you don't have those things, make sure you go out and look for them. So make sure you are prepared to go ahead and file your taxes.
And Evan, how about you? The number one piece of advice you would give people for behavior this year that's going to help them out next year?
I mean, Ansel went through a lot of the highlights of things that you actually need to know. And for so many people who are counting on this big return, and unfortunately, it is going to be less than on average than before. And for a lot of people, this is the only time in their lives where they get some large upfront money that they can then use to benefit themselves and their family.
So any advice on how they ought to use that money?
Most people use it to paying off debts and to paying bills. And I wish I could say something as simple as, we'll just save you money and invest long term. Unfortunately, that's not a reality for most families in Massachusetts.
But at least for some relief would be a good idea.
Absolutely.
All right. Evan George is host of Bostopia News, and Ansel Tejada is the program manager of financial empowerment at MassCap. You two are very helpful. Thanks for joining us for Budget Boston.
Thank you for having us.
All right. 15 days left. Remember to pay those taxes, and we're going out on The Tax Man by the Beatles. If you think that intellectual property law sounds boring, we are going to fix that. Weird and fascinating copyright fights are raging all around us right now, and they could affect everything from the shirts in your drawer to the toys you give your dog. We're looking at three recent cases today, caught up in it all: Jack Daniels, Andy Warhol, and even the Red Sox. Joining us now, New England Law, Boston, Professor Peter Carroll, to tell us more. Professor Carroll, welcome.
Thank you very much.
You're going to educate us, right?
Oh, yeah. We're going to have some fun.
Okay. So we're going to start with baseball because the season just started. So we'll talk about the Sox. They recently got ensnared in an ill-fated trademark application that was started by Major League Baseball. So tell us what happened.
That's right. So MLB filed for the word Boston. And, you know, we're all familiar with the Boston logo, right? With all
I'm
the
sorry. Kind
of, yeah, you can all of us just laugh when we see that, right? Apparently, they say, unbeknownst to the Boston Red Sox, MLB sort of handles the IP for their teams. And of course, there was a lot of reaction to that saying, you can't own Boston.
And that's basically what they were saying, right? Was, we're going to trademark the whole word Boston, not just the special Red Sox shape of it or something, but Boston.
That's right. That's right. They did, you know, they did limit it to within the connection with baseball. So clothing for baseball or entertainment services for baseball. But the way trademark works is it's not so narrow, right? If you're going to get something like in connection with baseball, you could easily say, well, then you can't do it for basketball because those are similar athletic things. So by making a claim for the word Boston, even in connection with something like baseball stuff, you're really reaching for the word itself and going to be very concerned about them being the only ones to be able to sell it on clothing.
So why would they even do that?
Well, MLB has a reputation for being what we call a trademark bully. They're a very known quantity. I was just looking it up before. They've even at one point filed to oppose, the Build-A-Bear people brought in, wanted to do Build-A-Tiger. And they went out and opposed Build-A-Tiger, I would only think because of Detroit Tigers, right? So you're now saying, I'm not going to let somebody else have Build-A-Tiger to have his plush toys, right? So they're known for going out there and constantly enforcing their IP in a very aggressive way.
So wait, did Build-A-Tiger work? Were they able to stop Build-A-Bear from building a tiger?
I believe they abandoned their application. I don't know if they went ahead with their Build-A-Tiger program. We'd have to look into that, but they certainly, the application is no more.
But the Red Sox didn't like this, right?
The Red Sox, as I understand, whether they didn't like it just because they got so much reaction in the press to having done this, but they abandoned it immediately in response to the pressure that they received from the public and academics like us.
And my understanding is that the legal community thought it was unlikely that MLB would have succeeded in copywriting an entire city.
Correct. I think that's a fair statement.
All right. So let's move on, because now, so this one's kind of interesting. The Supreme Court, you're watching this really carefully. They're going to more or less decide whether or not Andy Warhol is a thief, right?
Well, that's a loaded term. I'm not sure to go that far. But
okay, but it was fun.
Yes, it
was. All right. Tell us what's going on there.
So we have a case where Andy Warhol was, of course, known as one of the great kind of appropriators in art history, in which he would kind of work with source materials. And one of the source materials he worked with was from a photograph made by the photographer Lynn Goldsmith of the artist Prince.
Formerly known as,
thank you very much. It turned out he had permission for the one piece to do for a magazine cover. But unbeknownst to a lot of folks at the time, it turned out he did a series of additional works without permission, all based on sort of the similar source photograph. Fast forward, those source photographs make it into permanent collections. Those later works make it into permanent collections. They become licensable works by the Warhol Foundation. They start licensing the other unpermitted ones to magazine covers. Lynn Goldsmith, the photographer, finds out and threatens to sue. And one of the interesting quirks of this case, it's the Warhol Foundation themselves that brought the lawsuit. They said, oh, yeah, this is fair use. We're going to sue you, which is a pretty sort of preemptive, aggressive move by the Warhol Foundation to sue.
So the Warhol Foundation sues the photographer. So wait, the photographer takes the picture. The Warhol Foundation starts to license out Warhol art based on the photograph, but then the Warhol Foundation sues the photographer.
Exactly, saying, you're going to threaten us with infringement? Oh, yeah, we're going to sue you
to
prove that it's
you first.
Not infringement.
Okay, and why does the, like, I'm looking at a picture of a printout of a Warhol that is at the Institute of Contemporary Art here in Boston.
Yes.
How does this come home to art lovers and museum goers, et cetera? Why does this matter?
Yeah, so I think two core ways. One is that we do have museums with a lot of works by appropriation artists in their collection. The ICA is a good example of that. The electric chair piece, from 1971, I think there was a series of them before that. I don't know, sitting here today, whether Warhol had permission to use the underlying source photograph. At that point in his career, he often was just using photographs without permission. Interestingly, he got sued a few times early in his career, and by the 80s, when the Goldsmith action was going on, he was regularly either getting permission or having his own people at the factory take his photographs for him so he wouldn't have to worry about being sued. So he got pretty savvy about IP. But when you come to a museum like the Boston Area Institutions with a lot of works in their collection, especially by the Pictures Generation artists, people who work with other source material, it starts to be a little worrying for these local area museums about, do we have the rights to show this stuff? Could there be an aggressive photographer that comes after us and says, take that off your wall? That multi-million dollar painting you have in your collection, you actually can't show it anymore because it's rooted in copyright infringement. So if I was sort of counsel advising these museums, I'd be a little bit worried about what's coming down the pike with this Warhol decision.
So I'm going to play you a couple of pieces of sound. First is from Gregory Garr. He's a lawyer for the National Association of Manufacturers. Oh, wait, I've jumped a little bit ahead here. I've jumped a little bit ahead. I'm going to save that sound for a little bit later because we're going to talk about dog toys, and that sound is for the dog toys. But I want to stay in the Warhol for a minute longer because I think the other question that comes up for me here, I'm going all the way back to a segment that we did with a DJ named Real P, where we talked about sampling, right, and sort of the history of sampling in music. And what is, in this kind of fair use world, which is my understanding is the doctrine that's happening here, what is the difference between being inspired by somebody else's work and turning it into something new, something that's a new creation, versus somebody saying, you took my work and you copied my work? And how do we keep seeming to adjudicate this over and over again? Do you understand my question?
I think I do understand your question. And I think it's a fair question because there are no bright line answers in this space, right? A lot of it is so contextual. It is so based on what are the norms in that field? What is accepted practice in that field? And what kind of factors can we put together to say whether we want to allow this without permission? And the reason we go back and forth so often with these cases is, in the famous words, I believe Lawrence Lessig, fair use is the right to hire a lawyer, right? We basically have the ability to say, yeah, there's just some factors, but we never quite know how these cases are going to come out. So one way of looking at the Warhol fair use case is to say, this is going to be great. We're going to have some more guidance on what is fair use. And that might apply to appropriation art. It might apply to sampling in the music context. More often than not, the Supreme Court seems to sort of sidestep giving us clear answers on fair use. And instead, what they might come down the pike and say is something like, well, Warhol, for this very specific narrow reason, he was a sophisticated practitioner. He could have paid for a license. So we're going to say in this narrow case, he should have gotten permission. But that's not going to help us in some other cases where there's not a sophisticated celebrity artist to play with a lot of money who knew how to use the resources. So part of the problem you see in fair use is it's so specific to the case. And every case is so different that it's very tough to advise as an attorney beforehand what the artist can do going forward.
All right. So we're speaking with Peter Carroll of New England Law, Boston, and we do have a very different case now. I never thought I'd say the phrase whiskey and dog toys, but I am now going to turn to whiskey and dog toys. Tell us what's going on.
Well, it's fun being a trademark professor. Right? This is the kind of stuff we get in our class. So we have here a case that is currently also pending before the Supreme Court. And before I go, I hope I can convince you these are actually related cases to the Warhol one. So this is a dog toy that looks an awful lot like the Jack Daniel's whiskey bottle, and I can show you that I'm holding it right here.
Yep.
Right? All the dogs in the audience just love that.
That's right.
And so they basically use what we call the trade dress, which is sort of the look and feel of the bottle itself. And there's
So you've got a dog toy that is next to a Jack Daniel's bottle. The dog toy is Bad Spaniels, and it is sitting right next to the Jack Daniel's bottle. They do look a lot alike.
They do look a lot alike, and that's intentional, because this is what the Silly Squeakers folks, which is the name of this, says is a parody, right? They say that Jack Daniel's takes itself too seriously, like MLB before. before. They're using a lot of kind of assertions of intellectual property. They really kind of want to say, our brand is really important. And so Silly Squeakers comes in and says, well, we're just kind of making this a little more silly, goofy. Like, there's a lot of scatological humor on the bottle, right? We have the old number 2 on your Tennessee carpet, right?
As opposed to
the usual number 7 that we get on the Jack Daniels bottle. So they're really kind of going at it, right? And part of the Supreme Court precedent before this says, well, parody is supposed to look like the original. That's the whole point. If it doesn't look enough like the original, people don't get the joke. Now, you have a bunch of justices recently at oral arguments saying, I don't get the joke, right? So it's going to be interesting to see how they come down on this one and whether the world is safe for squeaky dog toys.
So it's safe to assume that Jack Daniels is not pleased about bad spaniels.
Very safe to assume that. Yeah.
So what if Jack Daniels wins? Because there are a lot of products out there that parody known brands.
Absolutely. And if Jack Daniels wins, I think that it's a little bit concerning, and I think they might win. Now, of course, with everything in the Supreme Court, you're worried about how they win. What is the language the court's going to use to tell them no? One way of looking at this case might be simply to say, well, this is just a commercial product. It's not expressive. If it were expressive, like an artist's work, then we might be a little more worried about the trademark parody issue. But because this is just a cheap toy, mm-hmm. we don't have to worry too much about it.
And that's how it ties back to Warhol.
It's all about what creators are going to be able to do going forward with appropriating either other works or brands.
You did it. You brought it all the way back to Warhol.
Cheers.
It's like you're a teacher or something. All right. Peter Carroll is a professor at New England Law Boston. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Amanda Beland and Rob Lane with Bart Tocci, John Bender, and help from Tyra Brooks. Marquise Neal is our senior technical director. Titus Faladun is our executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.